Thank you for tuning in to the May 16th, 2005 Indie Newswire show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org, and beyond. This show is dedicated to Jeff Free Lures and the June 10th through 12th Weekend of Resistance. We will hear audio from a documentary about Jeff Free Lures, and I will also be receiving a call from Dylan, a friend of Free and member of his defense network, for an extensive interview. And now we will hear Jeff Lures' keynote address to the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference at the University of Oregon on March 6th, 2005.
Hello and welcome to the 23rd Annual E-Law Conference. I apologize for not being there in person today. I simply couldn't get away. My name is Jeffrey Free Lures. In 2001, I was convicted of burning three SUVs and the attempted arson of an oil truck. I am currently serving a 22-year prison sentence for actions that injured no one and resulted in less than $50,000 in damage. The state has labeled me an eco-terrorist and a member of the Earth Liberation Front. I am not a terrorist. I am a man guided by my conscience. Over the years, many people have asked me if it was worth it. The answer is simple. Yes. Prison has not broken my spirit. The threat facing humanity is far more intimidating than any prison cell. Environmentalists are often accused of exaggerating the problem. I think that is because the truth is far more tragic than anyone wishes to believe. Perhaps the most dangerous element of global warming is that it is not viewed as an immediate threat. Climate change has been a gradual process that is quickly building to its climax. By the time the threat becomes a clear and present danger, it will already be too late to act. Drastic changes are already occurring in the Arctic. In 2002, researchers at the University of Alaska concluded that an estimated 24 cubic miles of ice is melting from Alaskan glaciers annually. From the mid-1950s to the mid-1990s, melt held steady at a rate of about 13 cubic miles a year. In the last few years, that rate has nearly doubled. Alaska's annual mean temperature has increased at a rate equal to four times the average global rise. The Arctic Ocean has seen an average rise of 10 degrees Fahrenheit higher than the global average, making the Arctic the fastest heating region on Earth. According to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, Arctic ice is 40% thinner than it was just 30 years ago. It is predicted that by 2015, the Arctic will be free of ice during summer months, and is expected to be free of ice year-round by 2070. Studies have suggested that global sea level has risen 7.8 inches in the last 100 years as a direct result of melting glaciers and a rise in ocean temperatures. The rise in sea level has increased coastal flooding and severe weather patterns around the world. The rise in global sea temperature, along with other human pressures, has effectively destroyed or threatened with destruction 70% of the world's coral reefs, as reported by the Global Coral Reef Monitoring Network. The report, compiled by 240 scientists from 96 countries, marks an increase of 11% over the last evaluation in 2000. The loss of coral habitat, compounded with massive overfishing, is contributing to complete collapse of the world's fish stocks. The depleted fish stocks are unable to recover due to continued commercial fishing and damaged marine ecosystems. The potential loss of this food source has disastrous implications for millions that rely on fish as a staple part of their diet, leading Britain's Royal Commission on Environmental Pollution to state the destruction of the world's oceans is now the world's gravest environmental problem after climate change. Recent findings published in the journal Nature indicate that climate change is worse than previously thought. The world's largest climate prediction experiment, coordinated by Dr. David Frame of Oxford University, concluded that global temperature could increase by 3.6 to 20 degrees Fahrenheit. That is nearly double the 2.5 to 10.4 degrees predicted by the IPCC. The experiment simulated what would happen if carbon dioxide in the atmosphere were double the 280 parts per million found before the Industrial Revolution, a scenario that is likely to be reached by 2050. More disturbing, however, was chief scientist for the project David Stainforth's statement that even present levels of greenhouse gases maintained for long periods may lead to dangerous climate change. In January 2004, the first comprehensive assessment of the effects of climate change was published. The report, led by Chris Thomas, a conservation biologist at the University of Leeds, and co-authored by 18 scientists from around the world, make this the largest collaboration of its type. The researchers worked independently in six biodiversity-rich regions around the world, comprising 20% of land surface. The report concluded that by 2050, more than 1 million species could be driven to extinction because of climate change. That number comprises a quarter of all known land and animal plants. The report found that much of that loss, more than 1 in 10 of all land species, is already irreversible because of damage caused by global warming. In January of this year, a panel of prestigious scientists warned an international convention gathered at the United Nations educational, scientific, and cultural organization headquarters in Paris, France, that species are being lost globally at a rate 100 times faster than the average rate of the Earth's history. The finding supports the belief that the world is on the cusp of another mass extinction, different from the five mass extinctions of the geological past, only in that this event is caused by human activity rather than external environmental changes. The panel said tens of thousands of species are already committed to extinction. Many scientists are beginning to warn that the danger zone of global warming is not something we are going to reach in 50 years, but rather it is the stage we are entering now, commonly referred to as the point of no return. Already we are beginning to witness dramatic changes in climate and its effects on various ecosystems. Each of the hottest 15 years on record have all occurred since 1980. Even with the various treaties designed to curb global emissions, not enough has been done to reduce greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. In fact, in 2003, carbon emissions from the burning of fossil fuels reached a record high of 6.8 billion tons, a nearly 4% increase from the previous year. It is widely feared that even if all greenhouse gas emissions ceased, the cycle of climate change may have already been put in motion. Dr. Rajendra Pachauri, chairman of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, told the Independent UK in January that widespread dying of coral reefs and rapid melting of Arctic ice had driven him to the conclusion that the danger point the IPCC had been set up to avoid has already been reached. He called for immediate and very deep cuts in pollution if humanity is to survive. For the first time in the known history of the Earth, one species controls the fate of the planet. Humans are amazing creatures with extraordinary reasoning capabilities. Our capacity to create is only outweighed by our ability to destroy. The governments of the world were warned about the dangers of global warming in the late 1980s. Science, since then, has only confirmed human influence on climate change. We cannot count on our governments or world bodies to solve this problem. Those organizations have not only proved ineffective, they have demonstrated themselves to be unwilling. It is the individual that is the foundation for change. It is our individual concepts of what is valuable, what are acceptable social norms, and what constitutes morally unacceptable behavior that create the societies in which we live. Currently, it is acceptable for a corporation to make billions of dollars while releasing toxins into the environment, promoting environmental destruction and climate change. Yet it is unacceptable to sabotage or otherwise use property destruction in attempt to slow human progress toward catastrophe. An immediate change in thinking patterns is a prerequisite in creating the social change needed to stop the wanton destruction of our planet. The above-ground and underground movements must learn to complement each other. There is no more time for discord because, frankly, we are running out of time. Action is needed now on all fronts. Action that confronts the cause of the problem and not just the symptoms. Those who disagree with direct action must recognize the necessity for it. We can no longer afford to refrain from or condemn direct action. And those in the underground must recognize and understand that action alone has never changed public conscience. Our only hope is to work together. We are united in our fate, and we must be united in our struggle. Now is the time to resist with all our might. From the legal to the illegal, action must be taken. Another world is possible, and only we can make it happen, but we have to act together, and we have to act now. Thank you.
Circus. bring home to everybody on Earth the fact that we're living in a planet with limits and that we're bumping up against those limits. Basically, each year we're pumping about 7 billion tons of carbon into an atmosphere whose upper extent is about 10 miles overhead. The facts underlying the science are real simple. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere traps in heat. For 10,000 years, we had the same amount, 280 parts per million, until a little more than a century ago when the whole world began to industrialize using coal and oil. That 280 is now up to 360. That is a level the Earth has not experienced for 420,000 years.
The fear is that there could be very rapid and an intensified species loss of both plant and animal species as the result of global warming.
The decade of the 90s was the hottest, at least in the last millennium. We have all just enjoyed the hottest October on record. I like to think of it as gift wrapping on the time bomb. And the planet is heating at a rate faster than at any time in the last 10,000 years.
Now, personally, it's almost impossible for me to put my brain around that kind of reality. It's so immense, it's hard to even imagine. And yet, here you have people whose lives are devoted to studying these sorts of dynamics that are saying that this is what's happening.
And we've actually altered the timing of the seasons. Spring now arrives almost 3 weeks earlier in the Northern Hemisphere than it did 20 years ago. We are changing the rhythms of nature by which we have lived our lives and planted our crops and written our poetry for 10,000 years.
So I think a lot of environmentalists, when they look at those sorts of realities, are astonished that there's not alarm about that reality, and that so little is known about it, and so few people really understand those sorts of facts.
We have heated the deep oceans. We have reversed the carbon cycle by 400,000 years. We have loosed a wave of violent and chaotic weather. We're living on an increasingly narrow margin of stability, and the evidence is all around us. We have set in motion massive systems of the planet with huge amounts of inertia that have kept this Earth hospitable for 10,000 years. And what's significant about these events is that this is precisely the pattern of weather that the computer models project as early-stage global warming.
I think there's a very much an emotional dynamic here that makes it so people don't want to look at these kinds of realities. I know personally it's very hard to look at these sorts of realities.
The biggest glacier on the planet, which is the Greenland ice sheet since 93, has been losing 3 cubic miles of ice each year, which is enough to cover the state of Maryland. The tundra in Alaska, which for thousands of years has absorbed methane and carbon dioxide, now is thawing and releasing those gases back into the atmosphere.
We tend to think that we should be risk takers, that we should invent new things, and we tend to assume that if there are negative or unanticipated impacts of that, that we can figure out how to mitigate it or make it right later. But the increasing evidence is that we're not, that in fact we are overstressing the ecosystems upon which we depend and all the other living things on Earth depend, and that while we do come up with some very ingenious ways to mitigate that damage, the damage keeps accelerating in almost every area.
New research shows that prehistoric climate changes have happened not as gradual transitions as scientists used to think, but as very abrupt shifts, and that very, very small changes in a very delicately balanced atmosphere have produced very large outcomes. So not only are we gambling with our futures, we are gambling with our eyes blindfolded. We can't even read the cards we've been dealt.
Sometimes it almost reads like science fiction, the more you read these scenarios, and it's just, it's hard to believe. And yet, increasingly, people who study these things for a living are very much expressing alarm.
If we could magically stop all our coal and oil burning tomorrow, we would still be subject to a long spell of costly and traumatic weather extremes. And that the failure of the industrial world to deal with this problem amounts to biopolitical terrorism.
I mean, there's so many levels of environmental deterioration that we could look at that need to be addressed. I think as a culture, we're doing a terrible job educating people about almost everything related to our environment. I study grassroots environmentalism globally and write about it. For example, in the book Ecological Resistance Movements, The Global Emergence of Radical and Popular Environmentalism. We're continually amazed at how little in the mainstream press there is about the gravity of the environmental situation. So, for example, most people aren't aware that 25% of the wild mammals on Earth are considered endangered by some of the best environmental scientists on Earth. And so a natural question, of course, is why is that? And an easy answer, and there's probably a lot of truth to it, is that those who profit from that media know quite well that that's a business about selling stuff. You don't want a lot of downer messages about how buying stuff insults the environment. The advertising media is very effective at getting people to view larger cars and having greater horsepower as something that's in some way virtuous, something that we should all aspire to. The ecological evidence is that's a major factor in the whole likelihood that human-produced emissions are increasing the global average temperature. Well, of course, there's all sorts of tactics that people use to try to address the environmental crisis. There's lobbying and letter writing or electoral politics. You try to get people that you think care about your issues in office. I think we call it mainstream environmental branch, if you will, of the radical environmental movement, a branch that definitely had this life-centered ethics, but nonetheless had not completely despaired of the American political system and thought that the civil disobedience and even the sabotage was still a strategy to shape the structures and laws and enforcement regimes of American civil society. Whereas you had another group that was saying American civil society is bankrupt, the laws only support the interests of corporations, and we should not be putting any energy into reforming that system. See, with increasing frustration over the difficulty in moving political systems, some people are deciding that they've got to do more than electoral politics, they've got to do more than civil disobedience, but they have to experiment with other forms of illegal action that they hope will, on the one hand, shock the public at large into understanding what they understand, that we are precipitating this extinction crisis. Starting in the late 1980s and escalating in the latter part of the 1990s is people beginning to use arson as a tactic.
I'm 22 years old, and I'm currently at Two Rivers Correctional Facility at Oregon Department of Corrections. Around 1 o'clock in the morning, me and a friend left to the Romania car dealership. We went in under cover of darkness. We made sure that there were no people around, that the buildings that were nearby were vacant. And we started a fire that resulted in $40,000 worth of damage to three trucks.
On the one hand, there's those that want to use those tactics as a form of trying to shock the public into actually confronting the realities. And then on the other hand, there are those that think that if some of these tactics can proliferate and become common, they can physically stop or they can provide a strong disincentive for people doing destruction behaviors.
We're the number one polluter in the world. I mean, we have a few rivals, but overall, the majority of pollution that comes from the United States comes from passenger trucks and vehicles. I mean, we have almost 250 million of them. When you take SUVs into consideration as being the number one polluter in that vehicle class, those are my reasons right there.
If you really want to understand that kind of tactic, whether you approve of it or disapprove of it, if you want to understand the motive behind it, you have to understand the sense of urgency. There's an old legal defense. It's called the necessity defense. Normally, it's against the law to trespass in somebody's house. But if the house is on fire and you have reason to believe there's somebody in there who might need rescuing, you're not going to be prosecuted for trespassing in that house because of the exigency of the situation. There's a higher moral value at stake, the protection of life, than the protection of a property boundary, a private property boundary, right? Well, the same kind of logic, I think, goes into the minds of people who, at least some of the people who engage in this kind of illegal tactic.
Well, when I first heard about the ELF, I was greatly encouraged, and I still am, and they continue to take great risks in defense of the Earth. I hope more people get involved in that. I think that more people will. More young people are not going to just sit and watch TV and take dope and just let everything go to hell.
Okay, we're going after huge gas-guzzling vehicles. So I think there's an analogy that can be made that they may be putting on the map, on the moral radar of the mass culture, those kinds of insults to the environment that nobody else was.
I won't say that by doing what I did, I expected the world to change. I don't think I accomplished anything more than burning three cars. What I did was an act of frustration, of having no other means that I have tried work.
A lot of these activists feel they're closed off from conventional means of political communication. Okay. That their voices are being shut off from public discussion. Then they begin to think, this is urgent, this is of great gravity, even if it involves some risk to us. How do we get this message out? How do we get our voices out?
For all intents and purposes, I don't have a voice. I can talk and talk and talk and write as many letters. I've even met with some of the congresspeople here in town. Nothing I have done has accomplished any change.
At the very least, it forces the public to recognize that there's some people who are very upset.
And what has this accomplished to him? What's good?
It's accomplished me getting 22 years in prison. It's accomplished, perhaps, hopefully, a couple more people want to pay attention now, or at least willing to listen.
These are forms of communication, whatever else they might be, whether we like them or not. These are efforts for people to communicate. What's the message? Well, the message is, wake up. Global warming is real. These gas-guzzling vehicles and our appetite for them is an ecological crime, and it must stop, and I'm willing to risk my freedom to make that statement because the mass culture is asleep. The mass culture is pretending that this is not a problem. And the mainstream media is not doing its civic responsibility, which is to educate people to the real threat.
This is Chevrolet's all-new Trailblazer. It's out brand new for $202. It's definitely a great value for the dollar, and it is worth looking at if you're in the market for any kind of a sport utility vehicle. You need to take a look at the new Chevrolet Trailblazer.
I don't know whether burning SUVs is that unpopular. Certainly there's a lot of people who drive them, but there are a lot of people that are appalled by what they represent, and there's a clear physical representation when you see somebody in these armored pigmobiles. There are a lot of people that are just furious at that, and not just anarchists.
Do you smell something burning? Well, it could be houses in your neighborhood, torched by radicals who say they're saving the earth. And to that, John Stossel says, give me a break.
I do, Barbara. I want the earth to be saved, too. But some of these activists are just clueless.
The strategic claim was, on the side that was advocating sabotage, is that it was time to actually stop the destroyers. Okay? And how might you do that? By waging economic warfare against them. And so if you can damage their equipment or increase their costs, their insurance, their security, their equipment, you might be able to drive them out of business. You might be able to redirect them into other areas that are perhaps ecologically less sensitive. When Dave Foreman, who was probably the most charismatic figure of the early Earth First founders, defended the use of sabotage. He said it's as American as apple pie, and he pointed to the people that he would consider to be patriots through the King's Tea and the, you know, Boston Harbor. Certainly, whether we look at sectors of the labor movement in America and other forms of popular resistance to perceived injustices, trying to cost economically someone that is your adversary is nothing new. It was something new when these tactics emerged specifically to defend nature. From that kind of perspective to one that basically says that so-called liberal democracies, as they are discussed and promoted in the Western world, are a sham. There's no such thing. There never has been. There never will be. Electoral politics is not up to the task of stopping this environmental crisis. A lot of folks have either engaged in that and become frustrated that they weren't being successful, or they've read enough to know that that's been going on for a long time and things keep getting worse.
You can have all the good ideas you want forever, and the system doesn't respond to good ideas. It responds to people actually resisting it in a real way. It's just going to run its course. It's going to obey its dictates and proceed according to its priorities, its dynamics. It doesn't care about your good ideas. It doesn't care about you standing there with your sign and saying, hey, I'm polite. I'm doing what the cops say. They'll pat you on the head and laugh up their sleeve. That's a nonsense way of imagining you're going to be a part of challenging the way things are going. It takes more than that.
Jeff Lewis, who, as you know, is now serving 18 years for this action,
23
for using an incendiary device to burn a motor vehicle, specifically, I believe it was a large sport utility vehicle, something that doesn't get very many miles per gallon. It's arguable that if that kind of tactic were occurring across the country, that it would draw attention to that form of consumption, in part because it might be increasingly over time seen as socially irresponsible to needlessly buy a big vehicle like that. So that might be part of what people are who engage in that kind of tactic are thinking.
As for the nearly 23-year prison sentence for crimes where no one was killed?
That type of behavior, I think, is the type of behavior that people in our community just aren't going to tolerate. I don't think Lane County is open for terrorists, and I think that the response that we saw here shows that that's how we're going to deal with this type of event.
If you can successfully label someone a terrorist, and if you can make that label stick, you can it's not very hard to make the general public quiescent if you go out to exterminate them.
We hear the word terrorism used routinely. I've argued and urged reporters on many occasions to not use the term terrorism for people who don't intend to kill or maim people. It reduces the sense of moral revulsion that we really ought to have to people who want to kill or maim as they pursue their political objectives. It takes the power, that sense of moral disgust, away from the term terrorism when the term is used loosely.
I've been called an eco-terrorist. I've been called domestic terrorist. Probably been called some other things that aren't as nice.
There was a lot of talk about eco-terrorism. The rhetoric was uncritically appropriated by the media. It was used by watchdog groups in the timber industry. It was certainly used by law enforcement authorities.
If you look at the definitions of those words, eco is short for ecosystem. Webster's definition of terrorism is the political use of terror and intimidation. If you put those two together, then you start to see companies like Weyerhaeuser as an eco-terrorist. You start to see companies that are destroying or polluting is eco-terrorists. I like to think of myself more as an eco-defender.
In the trees.
And it just takes one woman or one man to change the world and unite all our clans.
Hi.
And it
can be How's it you going?
Or you or
what are you
or
doing
me.
Up here, man?
It needs to be
well, trying to help set up a treehouse.
And I'm pleading with
so
you,
that we can serve this old growth forest.
It's not going to be done for you, and you have to make a stand because our very existence is in your hands.
Jeff grew up here in this quiet suburb of Los Angeles.
Here, have another one. Good girl.
We knew he was going to be a challenge to us when he was 5 years old. Our babysitter was on vacation, and we took him to the local parks, day care center.
Summer day camp program.
And I got greeted with him. First of all, he was saturated. There was a pond there, and he was wet. And he said, Mama, you got to fight for what's right in life, and if anyone messes with me, I'll kick him in the balls. 5 years old, he said this, and... that has not changed.
Look, plain and simple, the Earth can exist without us, but we cannot live without her. Now, there's a lot of very, very screwed up crap that's not going to change unless you make it. And I don't know what I need to tell you to get you off your ass to do something, but I can tell you one thing. If you don't, we're all going to die, we're all going to die, we're all going to die real soon. Because unless we fix our world, unless you fix your world, we're all doomed.
And there he is up there.
He used to build tree sits and...
Yeah, so he had a long record of being a tree sitter, forest activist, tree support person. There's no evidence that I'm aware of that either of them wanted to hurt anybody. Generally speaking, in the penal code, and I know this because I am a former, you know, state park peace officer, so we studied the penal code. You make very careful distinction between what is the intent of an alleged perpetrator. Obviously, so-called first-degree murder is when you lie in wait and you plan ahead of time to kill somebody. Second-degree murder is if you do something in the heat of passion. And then there's a variety of manslaughter charges that where you end up killing someone, perhaps through one or another form of indifference or negligence, and how much the weight of that crime, how bad that crime is, how morally culpable it is related to what the intent of the perpetrator was. Now, if someone commits a property crime, vandalism, and there's no intent to hurt somebody, but they hurt somebody, then that's one class of crime. And I see most media people being able to make those distinctions when they're looking at the crime beat. And then those distinctions and the ability to make those distinctions seems to evaporate when you're dealing with political dissent. So, for example, there was this recent article by Bruce Barcott in the New York Times magazine, I think it was. I think it was called From Tree Hugger to Terrorist. And he routinely applied the word terrorist as to people like Jeff who torched these gas-guzzling vehicles. He used the word violence to describe this tactic. He used the word firebombing repeatedly. In my judgment, using that kind of term makes people an even bigger target. When you use the word, and I talked specifically with him about this, firebombing for something that involves no explosives whatsoever, but what I think more accurately would be called an incendiary device. Now, I'm not justifying the use of it, but I think that just as the law goes to great lengths to make morally relevant distinctions with regard to intent and things like that, I think that when we talk about what people are in fact doing, we ought to be careful about the words that we choose, and we should strive for precision so that we're actually communicating accurately about what we're dealing with.
Jeff was charged with recklessly endangering life, yet no one was hurt.
He was the kingpin. He was the mastermind in our estimation. He's the guy that bought the fuel. He's the guy that owned the location that where the bomb factory was. We know that he was the guy that was probably running the thing.
Jeff's bomb factory was a lock-up garage that served as a community hangout. His bomb was a milk jug filled with camp stove fuel.
This is a device that can easily be made by anybody using very common materials, you know, an empty milk jug, a sponge, and some incense and some matches, and you've got yourself an incendiary bomb.
I think that by definition, bombs are intended to explode, usually with the intent to harm someone. What I used was specifically intended to start a fire. It started a fire. And it didn't go any further than that.
Well, right.
Meant to start a fire.
A firebomb and a bomb, generally speaking, if we were being precise, involves an explosive force of some sort. That apparently, to the best of my knowledge, was not something that he used. And in fact, if you look at virtually all cases attributed to either the so-called Animal Liberation Front or the Earth Liberation Front or Earth First, I don't know of any case where explosives were used. These movements have not kind of crossed a threshold to using explosives. And I don't think ordinary people know that. And ordinary people don't know that because the rhetoric of terrorism makes you think about bombs, right? And language like firebombing.
Especially after 9/11.
Quite right. So it's even worse to use that rhetoric in the wake of 9/11, when people have far more fear of terrorism than they had reason to be afraid of before.
They charged him with 3 counts of first-degree arson, 1 for each vehicle that was burned. There was only 1 fire, but somehow out of 1 fire, you can get 3 major charges.
If you look, for example, at how much time white-collar criminals get for activities that have far more destructive impact than, even if we just use a monetary calculus and just watch what kind of time they do, it will be obviously on its face unfair, unjust. The kind of things people at Enron and Anderson Accounting did, very big financial damage. If you look on the environmental side of things, in situations where an industry, for example, has committed a great amount of pollution, violate the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, very seldom are there even criminal charges brought. At most, there's civil penalties. And the civil penalties, if you compare the amount of damage, and these damage reports often, if not usually, run into the millions, if not the tens of millions of dollars.
As well as lives, human lives.
We can make reasonable suppositions that there's a significant number of people who have suffered ill health effects, and often we can make those claims about non-human organisms also. I mean, one could argue that the law has not evolved very far in these regards and does not yet fully take into consideration what seems to be a kind of emerging global ethic that suggests that all life forms have value, deserve respect, and should be here.
Why didn't we take a deal?
The only deal that I was offered is 12 years. I don't feel that I'm guilty of the crimes that I've been accused. I openly admit that I started the fire. You know, I openly admit that I destroyed the vehicles and I did it consciously and willingly. I'm accused of basically trying to kill someone, of putting someone's life at severe risk. I know that I haven't done that.
You know, we don't necessarily agree with all of Jeff's philosophies and ideologies. But it's our belief that in a democratic society, we have a right to those. And that, you know, quite frankly, we think that the majority of Jeff's punishment is being heaped upon him, not for his crime, but for his ideology.
I know when the judge came back, my heart was definitely pounding. But when I was all said and done, I wasn't shocked.
Certainly feel like a life sentence, wouldn't it? I mean, it would be a devastating thing for anyone, especially someone who thinks that they're really acting altruistically in a pro-life, with a pro-life agenda.
Should I stay here for the duration of my sentence? My parents will be dead. Some of my friends might pass away.
Jeff has lodged his appeal. After spending $20,000 on legal fees, he can no longer afford an attorney. He is seeking legal aid. Since this interview, Jeff has been banned from any future visits by the media.
The entire world and life that I've had up to this point will be non-existent 21 years from now. That's hard to swallow. I mean, that's real difficult. But I can't look back knowing what I know and having what I have in my heart and say that I regret trying to make things better.
My
one of the principles that we talk about in ethics is proportionality. So, I mean, justice is about rendering to each their due. You know, it's not just about, quote, do the guilty get incarcerated, do the innocent go free? It does have to do with proportionality. And in my considered opinion, that was a very unjust sentence.
Tired of all the yuppies driving those gas-guzzling SUVs?
Rainier is one powerful vehicle.
Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
400 horsepower.
500 horsepower.
I don't like the idea of
SUVs and America's addiction to oil.
Would you agree that's plenty of power?
All about power.
Power?
590 horsepower.
If you drive an SUV, a sport utility vehicle, you're ruining the environment. You're also selfish and stupid and dangerous.
My life, my SUV.
Oh, I go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
I really like the versatility of an SUV.
I helped our enemies develop weapons of mass destruction.
What if I need to go off-road?
So what if it gets 11 miles to the gallon?
It's my First Amendment right.
I gave money to a terrorist training camp in a foreign country.
I feel safe in my SUV. I'm above everyone else.
I help teach kids around the world to hate America.
I'm above everyone else.
If you drive a big V8, it's time to celebrate. They're gonna fight a war for you.
to keep gas prices cheap. So when you drive or when you sleep, you can do it in an air-conditioned room. For driving is your right, so let's get out there and fight. You can read that in the Constitution.
I go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
Here we go now.
I go anywhere to fight for oil, be it olive, safflower, crude. For cooking, for cars, take a rocket to the stars for a back rub, romantic rendezvous. In your engine, on your face, or almost any place, a little dab of oil will get you through. Oh, I go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
I'm above everyone else.
My First Amendment right.
I like to sit up high.
Would you agree there's plenty of power?
I sent our soldiers off to war.
I'm above everyone else.
You're also selfish and stupid and dangerous.
My life, my SUV.
Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
Everybody.
I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, be it olive, safflower, crude. Looking for cars, take a rocket to the stars for a back rub, romantic rendezvous. In your engine, on your face, or almost any place, a little dab of oil will get you through. Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil. It's gonna be a great fight. Should only take a fortnight to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
I'm above everyone. I'm above everyone.
That was Skidmark Bob's SUV Love Mix.
To walk on sea.
She is prowling through all the religions. generations of men sing the time and time and time again. Their gods have made them special and above nature's law and the rest.
Like there, where that hawk is circling.